This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we delve into those difficult moments with some well-known people. I am Jim Daly, and joining me through the power of Zoom slash the internet slash magic, it is the one and only Giles Paley-Phillips. Hello to you.
Hello. Slash the guitarist in Guns N' Roses, and also the name word used for when you need a piss.
Indeed. Very true. Very true. Mm. Good.
We are when you want to cut something as well. Slash.
And also one of the keys on the keyboard. One of the keys on the computer. Yes. Keyboard. Slash.
Language is amazing, isn't
back
it?
Slash or front slash.
Words. Words have different connotations, particularly in the English language as well. Very lots of words that are either spelt the same or say the same.
Which actually, if you're someone whose English is not their first language trying to learn it, must be a bloody nightmare.
I think it is a difficult language to learn. I think it is a difficult... What's the easiest language to learn? See, I thought that German might be quite an easy one to learn.
My mate Rob grew up in Germany. He can speak German. I'll ask him. I don't know.
I'll have to ask old Susie Dent. She knows a lot about the German language.
About language in any language, she is your go-to person.
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe ask Susie what the
episode best... 3 of the Blank Podcast.
Smooth. Very good. Nicely done. Nicely done. Well, this is episode 10-something.
10-something. We've lost count.
I've lost count.
We're not even counting now.
No.
10-something. But what a fantastic guest.
Oh, I think this is one of the nicest guests we've ever had. A brilliant actor, a really nice guy, a massive Hull City fan. And just an absolute joy to talk to for an hour and a bit. I was teasing you up then to do the introduction.
I wasn't.
I was trying to set terrible. You up. I thought we could do this a bit.
This is why we'll never get a Radio 1 show. it's the brilliant Harry Lawty, who probably best known for his role as Robert in Industry, which came out sort of the end of last year. Fantastic program. I actually really, really liked it. I really, really loved the show, actually. It was really great. It's a very intense show. It's about the international finance industry. And it's sort of, you know, the hub of it in this large banking establishment where there's like an investment bank that these guys work for. And there's 5 grads. And it's basically them kind of working. It's not an internship as such, but it's that postgraduate placement, and they're all trying, all sort of vying for a permanent position. And it's the sort of cutthroat nature of it, but also the relationships of these five characters, and that's the sort of really fascinating part of the program. And as Harry alluded to on the show, it's very much a coming of age drama, really, in essence. But there's this sort of backdrop of this high intensity sort of finance world.
It's very different from my postgrad placement. I didn't really have one. I did.
Was it Acfield Courier? Was it?
I did, not quite. I did work experience at the Independent on the sports desk towards the end of my course, and then just like didn't leave. I just sort of hung around like a bad smell until they gave me a job. But it was. I mean, it certainly wasn't the sort of high-powered finance industry that Harry's character works in. It was mostly sort of typing up press conferences about manager Steve Bruce talking about why his left back's injured. It's very different, you know. We're in different industries here. We're in different worlds.
Yeah, but funny enough, though, we do talk about the sort of, you know, Harry's a big football fan, and actually, you know, some of his like his work, his acting work, there's certain sort of analogies with football as well, you know. So and that kind of performance aspect of it. So that's an interesting kind of take on it. So yeah, there is a lot. We do talk about football a little bit on the podcast. As we normally do, we try and get it in, don't
well,
we?
Well, any guest that can sort of equate their work in football analogies is going to be one of my favourites.
Exactly.
Come on again. That's great.
But Harry's been in loads of other things as well. There's a show on Netflix that's coming out recently, and, you know, he does a lot of theatre work. I know he's done a lot of theatre work in the past. So, yeah, he is certainly someone to look out for. He's a tremendous actor, and I think, I think he's going to be very sought after.
He's going to be a star kid, and we had him on the podcast, you know, at the start of that journey. Now, I think you will fall in love with Harry, I think, if you're someone that doesn't maybe know of him listening to this podcast, because he's just really, really nice, an absolute pleasure to talk to. I'm confident, I think he's going to become your new favourite actor, because he was just an absolute joy to have on. So I think we should just delve into it.
I think we should, but I do think we should do a tweet first.
Oh, we should. I'm 100 and something episodes and I still forget to do the tweets at the start.
Yeah. And the thing is, listeners, we haven't been talking about this off air for the last 10 minutes.
Exactly. Literally looking for the tweets as well. The thing is, we're doing a later than normal recording. So
this is it. We're quite fatigued.
Yeah, exactly. I had a weird nap today that sort of threw me off.
It's thrown you off, hasn't it? I've got a lovely tweet here from Slee Parrish. She says, "Hi, just been listening to some podcasts by The Blank Pod. Some really interesting interviews. Lovely to hear different people and ideas brought together by Giles and Jim. Highly recommend a listen, and you must share."
Oh, that's very nice. The reason I laughed a little bit there is because it sounds like one of our previous guests, Steve Parrish, maybe, as a sort of pseudonym. I'm surprised. And the episode with Steve Parrish was particularly interesting. Then I'd be like,
that would have been good. That would have been good. It could be. It's the sort of thing where I don't know if you've ever had any kind of a bot account. It's the bot account name, isn't it? Mm. I had James Paisley Phillips once.
Oh, what? So someone created a bot account of you?
Yeah, it was my face, but it was James Paisley Phillips.
Okay, that's weird. They used my name. That's...
Yeah. But anyway.
It wasn't me.
No, yeah, let's put it out there. But Slee Parrish could be Steve. Could be the bot. Yeah. Got the bot version of Steve Parrish. No offence to Slee. No. I'm sure this is not a bot account, and we really do appreciate your kind words.
Thank you. It's really nice. It's lovely.
I hope we haven't lost you as a listener. No.
And thank you for asking people to share it, because that is nice as well. Because I think when you give a personal endorsement like that, people are more likely to share and get on board. And if it brings one person back on, you know, to the podcast, we really appreciate that. So thank you, Slee. Sorry for me derailing your lovely tweet there. But we do appreciate it massively. I've got one here from Emma Blackwood. And her Twitter handle is M's11 with 6 M's. Anyway, she's put, "Husband's watching the football for a change. So I thought I'd listen to Blank Pod for the first time. Great chat with Lorraine Kelly.
Love Lorraine.
What an episode that was. Look forward to listening to some others in the coming days, weeks. Nice to have something else to do of an evening." And then she's followed up with another tweet saying, "Funny to listen to it when it was recorded at the start of lockdown last year. Talking about how Lorraine hopes we don't come out of lockdown too quick. And here we are still a year on." I'd forgotten that we recorded with Lorraine almost a year ago.
It doesn't seem that long ago, does it?
It doesn't, but we are in a different world now. And we were, I think we all were not too sure what would happen with lockdown. But obviously, we're back in it, you know, for lockdown three, the one after the sequel.
2.1. That's what my kids are calling it, 2.1.
2.1.
Yeah, well, they don't feel like the last one was a proper.
Okay, fair
so
enough.
So this is 2.1.
Yeah. I'm going to call it that. That actually makes it feel not as bad, actually. That actually makes it feel more bearable. Okay, anyway, look, shall we now introduce this week's guest? This is just the delightful Harry Lawty on the Blank Podcast.
Whereabouts are you? Whereabouts is it?
So they live out in like Oxfordshire, I suppose, but I normally just say Oxford. But we're near kind of Whitney, if you know. I don't know, but
okay.
But yeah, I mean, I've been living here kind of well, not this year, last year, when everything sort of kicked off. I was really lucky, actually. I was really fortunate because I was living with a mate in London at the start of 2020 because he had a spare room. And but it was only supposed to be sort of like a temporary thing, and so it was always the plan that I was going to move out on the 20th of March, and so I did. And my plan was, I'll head back to mum and dad's for a couple of weeks, find a new place in London, and then move back in. And obviously, went into lockdown on the 23rd, so I kind of just stayed.
I'm still here.
What's that been like? Has it been all right?
It's been really nice, actually. In a lot of ways, you know, it's been years and years since I've lived with my parents. Quite a long since I was like 13, I haven't lived with them really, and so it's been really kind of refreshing in a way. And it's definitely one of the things I'll look back on and kind of treasure, I think, really, because you know, you just don't get to, with work and stuff like that, you don't always get to spend that much time with them. And you know, I've certainly like fallen into the trappings of like being a kid at home again, which is probably not a good thing. I try and do a few chores as well and do my bit. But it's been really nice to spend all this time with them, actually.
Yeah, I think because I actually think that's been one of the things of lockdown. So me and my wife have moved back in with her mum. That was always our plan anyway, but that sort of got sped up by lockdown. And my parents are down on the south coast in Chichester, and obviously haven't seen them. We've got a daughter who's 15 months old, so they saw her for a bit, and then lockdown happened, and then they sort of haven't seen her apart from on Zoom. And the whole sort of, you know, it's like your parents, like you're like, oh, I'll ring my mum in a bit, or oh, I'll see them in a bit, and then you don't. And then with lockdown, you're like, oh shit, I really do need to see them more often. I think for me, it's like strengthened that relationship a little bit more, actually, and make me realise how important it is.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think that's true of everyone. Like, even I've got an older brother, and he lives in Bristol, and so we haven't seen him that much throughout this year. He kind of came back and stayed with us for a couple of weeks around the sort of the middle of last year. But even with him, like, he FaceTimes more than he ever did before, I think, you know. And I end up kind of speaking to my brother like a lot more than I did before, in a way, which is really nice, because I think everyone feels a bit more inclined to just sort of stay connected, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that sort of irony that the fact that we aren't with each other and can't be together, but we've actually we have connected more.
Absolutely.
It's just a weird sort of paradox that we find ourselves in. Anyway, I was going to start because I've just binged Industry, which I thought was absolutely fucking amazing. I was really like just blown away by it, actually. It's the best thing I've seen in a while.
Oh, thank you very much. And,
and you were fantastic in it, man. What I was going to say is one thing about it, I thought, and I'm going to say this in the nicest possible way, it's quite Shakespearean in a way. And why I say that is that quite a lot of the stuff in it I didn't really understand.
Right, yeah.
But
you and me both.
Yeah. So like the international finance stuff, right? That kind of went over my head, but the relationships and obviously like the you five kind of grads, that stuff was so compelling. And obviously that's kind of the point of it. But with regards to the finance stuff, did you have to go like before when you were preparing for the role? Were you shadowing people? Did you get involved in doing anything like that, or was it just a case of let's just wing it?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a bit of winging it in there, but we did a bit of that. So we kind of spoke to a few people from within the kind of the real life finance world, and obviously did our own research individually. And so I tried to sort of quiz up as much as I could on that kind of stuff. But we're really fortunate in a sense that the two guys who wrote the show, Mickey and Conrad, they're former bankers themselves, and fairly recent former bankers. You know, it's not a particularly well trodden path, you know, going from international finance to screenwriting, but they've managed to like do it all right. But yeah, so they were our kind of showrunners in essence. So they were there all the time, and whenever we were really struggling with something or just trying to clarify what things meant, they were always on hand to kind of let us know which way to go, and just in general, kind of oversee. They were really keen to get the details right because it's their workplace, and they know that they'd have former colleagues and friends who were going to watch it, and so they really wanted it to be true to life, and it really was. Like, you know, a lot of the show is set on that big trading floor that you see. I mean, that set was just like mind blowing in its kind of size and scale, but also just like the detail was just ridiculous. You know, on my character Robert, on his desk, for example, he's got like business cards that say my name, and each of the 80 desks have their own kind of little personality, and so they were really keen to oversee all that and make sure it was true to life. But I used to give them stick, actually, to be fair, because I barely get any banking jargon in the entire eight episodes. so after a while, I was like, you guys are not dusty with any of this stuff.
Well, I guess your character's slightly different in that, you know, you kind of, it's the personal relationships that you make with the clients. And that's kind of obviously part of Robert's kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's trying to make those connections.
Yeah. It's maybe almost kind of poignant that he doesn't have a lot of, or we don't see him doing a lot of actual work, because it's part of his idea going into this internship that, you know, maybe an outdated idea that the kind of skills that he thinks are going to be relied upon, you know, the kind of skills that he thinks are going to be relevant, like charming people and showing them a good time and just being a slightly vague but generally charismatic figure. You know, he thinks that's going to be enough and he thinks that will suit him. And he comes into a workplace which is like literally in evolution, you know, and that's kind of a big theme of the show, is this whole industry is being encouraged to kind of move forward and change with the times and kind of respond to cultural movements. And there's certain people within the bank that are forcing through that change, and there's certain people that are resisting it and like things as they are, you know.
Mate,
and,
vague but charismatic is essentially how I've got through my entire life and career. they are two skills that you can combine and they will get you through anything. So I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he's maybe in the process of being found out, I think, in the show, and those kind of things catching up with him, because there are certain people at this workplace who believe it is a meritocracy, and, you know, it's not about who you are or where you come from or what you're bringing to the table. It's about just how well you can do the job. And I think he's slightly ill-equipped in that sense.
God, I sound so much like me. Oh, no, I was having so much in common with this character.
But, you know, it's a difficult time in life. I think in like that we've talked about this on the pod with other people, actually. We talked to Chris Addison quite a lot, I remember, Jim, about being a graduate and like going out into the world of work or if we're pursuing a career, and actually how difficult a time that is, because you're still kind of, you're pretty young still, but also like a bit clueless. Maybe you might go into something. I mean, obviously the guys in it, you know, you five characters in there are particularly wanting to get into that industry. But sometimes people go into things that they may not necessarily want to go into, or they're going into them for the wrong reasons. So it's just a difficult time of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
In general.
Yeah. And I think the sort of, hopefully our show really is in essence about that more than anything else, you know. Like, obviously, as I say, the writers are working from experience, but really they wanted to make a coming of age TV show, you know, more than anything. The bank is just a kind of cauldron for all that to kind of accelerate and go on and come into focus. But really, as you say, it's just like five young people working out who they are and who they want to be and how they want to be seen. You know, it's just a very intense kind of environment to be trying to figure that stuff out in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. God, I can't imagine. I mean, I'm not a financy person at all. My dad is a chartered accountant for 45
right, you
years.
You should be,
right? I literally got none of that. Like, such a failure, disappointment. I got none of that. He still does my tax return now. It is embarrassing. I'm 36. That should not be happening. But that... it's funny, isn't it? We're obsessed with coming-of-age movies and TV shows, aren't we? Like, I think, as a society. But that sort of period in your life, like, when you're that age, it seems so important. Like, just everything seems so... matters so much. And then you get a bit older and look back and you think, you're just a kid, and it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, you can do other stuff later. You can change your mind. Like, you can try another path. Like, it's just, I remember being that age and thinking, oh my God, this matters so much. But I don't know where that comes from, because it really doesn't.
Yeah. And it's so true to life. And I've thought that as well. Like, it's, I remember thinking when I was coming out of school and then drama school, and that you think, you realize you're only as valuable or as things are only as important as your last achievement. You know, when you're doing GCSEs at the age of like 16, whatever, like, that's the be all and end all. And then you do A levels and like, God, what was I worried about? And then you start real life. You think none of that mattered at all, you know, in some ways. And I think, I'm constantly, you know, I kind of see that in my own life as well. And I think the show is like just putting that into huge focus, and it just blows things out of proportion. Like, there's young people in the show who do crazy and irrational things that they haven't thought through, but they're just kind of caught up in a moment, you know?
Mm. Going back a bit then, what was school like? Did you enjoy school? Were you academic?
I love school, actually, to be fair. Not that I was, you know, I was decently academic, but I wasn't like crazily academic, but I just liked being at school. I always thought it made me a bit weird, actually, but the day I was always most excited on in a year was the day before the end of the summer holidays, because
really?
I was really bored on summer holidays, because I like the idea of like going back and seeing all my friends and like playing football and at break times and you know, like just clowning about. Like, I just like being amongst people, I think, and for that reason I always just love school. It's why I like working on a set now. I think it's probably my favorite thing about being an actor, maybe, is just the actual workplace itself. Is there's so much happening and there's so many people there. I love school. I think I was really lucky in as well. I went to nice schools, I think, like, and I don't mean like incredibly academic or impressive schools, just schools where there was a nice atmosphere and kids were nice, and you know, and I think that's just pot luck, really. I've got mates who were bullied as kids or things like that, and it just completely skews your experience. You know, I was just really lucky in that sense, and I had a good time at school.
Yeah, it is potluck is a good way of describing it, because really every kid should go to school and have a nice time and like meet like-minded people and want to go and enjoy learning and stuff. But you're right, some kids end up in schools, and a lot of it is like it's postcode lottery as well, you know, and which is not the kid's fault at all, but you end up in the school maybe not as good because of where you grew up and stuff, and end up hating it. And it does shape, I think, the rest of your life in terms of sort of positions of authority and people, you know, workplaces and wanting to learn. I don't know, but I think you're right, it can... So I've just gone on. I've literally just spoken about how being young doesn't matter, and now I'm talking about how being young really matters. I am nothing if not a huge hypocrite. It should be. It's nice to hear you say that, because I think that should be the experience of everyone, really.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and definitely there was some fortune in there. Like, I had a slightly unorthodox kind of school life, in a sense that, because basically my dad's in the RAF, so he's an engineer, and so my family was posted out to Cyprus like a couple of days after I turned five.
Wow.
And so my whole kind of early childhood, at least, was in Cyprus, really. And I went to like a service children's education school out there, and you know, maybe that's why I think that there's a different kind of tempo to school out there. You start much earlier at like, you know, 7 o'clock, and then you finish by lunchtime, and you can kind of just go out and, you know, have fun, really. It's not bad. It's pretty good. And in so many ways, it's kind of just like, because you're on a British Forces camp, and it's kind of like being in Britain. It's just so you happen to be in the Mediterranean as well.
Slightly better weather.
It's just a few less rainy days. Yeah.
How long were you there for then?
So we moved out there when I was five, as I say, and then I was actually out there until I was 13.
Oh wow! Yeah.
But yeah, my parents actually stayed a few years longer than me, but I came back early to go to like a theatre school over here, which was kind of bizarre the way it happened, really, because like. I'd started like secondary school in Cyprus, and you know, Cyprus was all I'd ever known. Like I couldn't remember living in England before that. And so for all intents and purposes, it's kind of my home really. And the place I most identify with and that culture, I suppose. And anyway, I was at secondary school and I'd sort of started, like taking part in like school productions and things like that. And, we did this when I was in year eight, so I must've been like 12. I think we did this production of Oliver Twist, and it was just a normal kind of British military secondary school, but they just had some really enthusiastic teachers in the theatre department. And that, again, it, like you say, it's potluck that you just meet these people that happen to like go above and beyond and really want to make something of, you know, not a great deal of facilities, but yeah, we did this production of Oliver and I just absolutely loved it and had the time of my life. And I'm a massive football fan and come from a, you know, big football family, and it was the first time I'd done something that that felt creative, but also had that kind of team element of football. You know, it felt like I was part of something bigger than yourself. You know, which I think is the appeal for a lot of actors. And had a world of a time. And then that summer, there was like a touring production of Oliver Twist from the West End that like was going around Europe, and they did a couple nights in Cyprus at this like amphitheater. And so, you know, me and my dad, we went to watch it because we thought, you know, we want to see how the proper people do it. And so he went to see it and it was great. And all the kids in this show just seemed to be from the same place. When we looked at the program, they all just said this place called Silver Young Theatre School next to it. And I was starting to take a real interest in acting at school. And my dad kind of very hypothetically said to me, like, do you think that's something you'd want to do? And I was like, yeah. And so then they like very hypothetically sent off an email to Sylvia saying, what's the deal? How does it work? Do you have to audition and stuff? And they got back a couple of days later saying, yeah, you audition. In fact, we're holding some auditions in a week and a half's time. And by complete coincidence, we were on holiday in London a week and a half later because it was a summer holiday. So we'd come back and we wanted to take a little mini trip to London. And so I went along to audition and I managed to kind of get in and then went really. And it was, you know, it was a mad sort of time because I was 13, and from sending off that email and seeing that production to starting my first day at Sylvia's was about 4 weeks.
Whoa,
really.
Blimey.
Wow. What did you do as your audition piece? Did you do a bit from Oliver?
I can't remember actually. I must've done something. I don't know if I think because you were supposed to like, you were supposed to sing, dance, and act, I think, in the audition. I think they wanted to kind of like test you in all the departments. But I think I did this monologue that I'd done at like a prize giving thing at my school in Cyprus, where it's this lad who tells this story from a day at school, and then at the end he realizes that his flies were undone the whole time, and it's kind of this like punchline thing. I'm not sure it was that great, but it managed to do the trick. But I can't remember what I sang actually. But yeah, and so life kind of changed really quickly. Well,
that's whirlwind. That's proper sort of whirlwind. Also, before we go on, we do have to also find out who is your football
team.
I'm a massive Hull City fan.
Oh wow! Okay, well,
are you okay? Yeah. No, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. No one's ever really expected, because you can't really tell, particularly from a voice, because I don't have much of an accent. And but yeah, all my family are from up north in Barton upon Humber, just across the bridge from Hull, and there wasn't really much of a choice, to be honest. I was a mascot away at Macclesfield when I was like 3 years
that's
old.
That's amazing.
So, you're both Palace fans,
yeah.
Right?
Both Palace fans, yeah.
I noticed.
Jim's actually wearing some Palace colours today.
So I've still got this.
Yeah. I actually went away to Palace a couple of years ago. I went it was actually the day that we got relegated. 4-0
Oh,
yeah. The 4-0 one.
Yeah. I was there for that.
It was a bit brutal, wasn't it? Yeah.
It was actually a good day. Yeah. But we kind of knew we were going down anyway. So there was a big turnout and they just sang for 90 minutes, basically. But
yeah, we got an early goal and that's what killed it, I think, from Wilf. But I like Wilf. I've been to the KC once. I think it was 0-0. Long way to go for a 0-0. My auntie lives in Hull, has done for a long time as well. So
I
remember sort of going to the Humber Bridge, and that was like a day out. A day out of the Humber Bridge. I mean, it's quite impressive. Yeah. But like, and now what? Now we're going home. Okay, cool.
I think it was one.
No, they're one of those teams. Actually, I would say I've got a bit of a soft spot for Hull. Like, you know, I always, you know, if they do, the few times they've been in the Premier League, they've sort of become the second team a little bit, I think.
Yeah. No, I think there's a certain charm to the team and the place as well. Like I say, a lot of people say, "Oh, my so and so," or "So I went to uni in Hull," or something like that. There's often that kind of connection with it, and my whole life I've just gone up there for Christmas. That's where all my family live, and so I kind of feel like a semi identity to it, but almost like I don't fully qualify in a sense. But like, but I really love it as a place, and like it gets a bit of a bad rap at times. Like, you know, I think it was like voted the worst place to live in Britain 4 years
was
running.
It?
like a few years back.
Wasn't it cult?
Then we had the city of culture. Yeah, we had the city of culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That maybe turned things around. But there's a few nice bits to it.
Lots of different places. When I was younger, we moved around as well because my dad's job, he accountancy, as I said, but for a construction company. So we lived in Spain and Dubai and Malaysia and stuff like that. I was very young. I was younger than, by the time I came back, I was like 5-6. I was younger than when you were out there. But do you have a sort of split sense of where you feel from? Or do you know what I mean? Like, maybe you don't feel like you're from anywhere rather than one place.
Yeah, I completely do, like, for sure. I think because, as I say, first and foremost, probably Cyprus is my home, but I'm not Cypriot and I can only speak a little bit of Cypriot. It's not like I'm fluent. But that's kind of where I consider where I grew up. Yeah. It's kind of like the place I know best. But then, as I say, I moved to London when I was 13, and like 13 onwards, those are kind of your most sort of impressionable years, I suppose, in terms of like working out your identity, I guess. And then this whole kind of northern side, like all my family, both sides of my family are from this little town up north. And that's where I've always been every Christmas for my whole life. And like, it always resonates whenever I go into like auditions, I'll start speaking and then, just as you do. And then someone say, "Sorry, where are you from?" Like, your accent is really weird. Cause I do all the kind of Bath, Grass, everything like that, but it's probably not fully embedded in the way I speak, and so I don't really know half the time, but I somewhere in the middle of those three places, I think, really. And also, now my family, they moved back from Cyprus about 6 years ago, and now they live in Oxford, and I was born in Oxford because my dad worked at Bryce Norton, so so I'm kind of semi from Oxford as
you've
well.
You've got like the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer accent thing going on. Leave everything.
But no, it's a really interesting thing. I don't really know. And if anything, I feel kind of lucky that I've got kind of close connections to a lot of places. Yeah. I certainly feel lucky that I was able to grow up abroad and just have another culture as like a given in my kind of life, you know. And I think that's really fortunate, I suppose.
Yeah.
Harry, what was it like? I mean, obviously, like you were saying, those impressionable years that when you were 13, being away from your folks, like being in London, you know, obviously training and doing your course, was that tricky? Was that challenging for you?
Yeah, it was hard, to be honest. Yeah, because I was only a kid, really, and like it's 2,000 miles away, I suppose, and also I had no desire to leave Cyprus. Especially, I loved my school out there. I had great friends and I just it was my home, I suppose, and I kind of just said to myself, like, if I managed to get into this place and we could sort of, and we worked out how we could afford going and stuff like that, and with a bit of help from my dad's work, and so if it all worked out and it was going to happen, I kind of just said to myself, you can't say no, you know, it's you just have to go. And I'm glad I did, because it was, you know, it was probably the best decision I've ever made. And I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I hadn't started then. But, you know, it was a tough call. I remember, like, about a week or so before I left, my dad said, you know, I don't know if this is a good idea, because he didn't want me, like, flying back after a month, not being able to deal with it, you know. So it was tough. But also, I had the best time as well. Like, I don't always think about that when I think back to going there. I think about how lucky it was to be at a school like that and get an education like that, you know. Because it's a bit of a dream place to be if that's what you're interested in. You know, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you do academic work and you have to keep up with that, otherwise there's consequences. and then Thursday, Friday, you just sing, dance, and act. And so, and the school's on like four floors, and two of the floors at the top are just kind of like dance studios, and then two floors below are classrooms. And so it's like the school completely transforms on Thursday and Friday, and they have an agency there, so when you join the school you automatically join the agency. So I kind of started working as a kid, which was crazy and a really weird thing to get used to. Like, obviously it didn't happen straight away, but when I did first get there, you'd be in a maths class as a, like a 13-year-old, and someone would put their hand up and say, excuse me miss, like, I've got to go work now, and they're like, all right, and then they just leave, you know, and they just go out for there and go and do whatever they're doing, you know, whether it's a TV show or a film or something like that, and or going off, leaving school early because half the kids at the school were doing West End in the evening.
Wow.
Like, half, you know, half, mad, isn't it? You know, half of my mates were actually in Oliver in the evening. Like, in my best mate at the school was the guy who won the BBC show.
Wow, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To
yeah.
be Oliver, and he was like the longest serving Oliver there was in the West End. And I saw him like on TV when I lived in Cyprus, and then I get to school and we end up being really close friends. Like, it's mad. My best friend to this day, Jake, he's from Scarborough, and maybe I kind of latched onto him because of that, but yeah. he was on Britain's Got Talent like back in the early days. And I remember seeing him on Britain's Got Talent. Wow. As like, he did a stand-up comedian as routine as like a 10-year-old kid. And I got to like the semi-final, and then I was sort of sat next to him in maths.
Wow.
Like a year later, and he, you know, he's my best friend to this day. But so yeah, like getting used to that just different culture of a school was just mind-blowing for me, and it was so exciting. And I just used to pinch myself on Thursday and Fridays that I got to go to school and do that, you know. And so yeah, it was great. It was hard, but it was great. And but it makes you grow up as well. You got to grow up fast. Like, cause I was away from my parents, and I was living with like a host family, like with a few other people from the school. Cause like the school is mainly like a day place. You know, they get a lot of kids from London or Essex, but obviously they need to have something arranged for the kids that they attract from up north. Like, I had mates from Scunthorpe and Scarborough, as I say. And so obviously they couldn't commute. Mm. So they had a few kind of like families that would like host you, I suppose. And
oh, okay, yeah.
The difficulty was that they'd all go home at weekends, obviously on the train, and I couldn't go back to Cyprus. I was there for 7-8 weeks at a time. But it makes you grow up, you know, forces you to kind of grow up faster than you would do otherwise. And I remember, I distinctly remember like a point in my life, maybe around 15, 16, maybe earlier, I don't know, where I just decided, okay, I'm just going to stop being upset at the airport when I go back to London. Because like, it's tiring after a while. Like every 6-7 weeks you go home, you spend a week at home for half term, and then you've got to do the whole being really upset and crying at the airport and mum's crying and all that. And you think, eventually I just got to a point where I said, this isn't like practical anymore. Like, I can't do it like this. I've just got to grow up. And my brother moved back to England at the same time as me, but he's older. He was, I think, 17 when he came back. And most of the kids who grow up in Cyprus and the forces move back at some point anyway, because obviously there's no jobs for us out there unless you do join the military. So it becomes unsustainable after a certain point. And so eventually people do come back for their education, for A-levels or BTEC, whatever. And so I actually ended up moving back at the same time as my brother on the same flight. But my parents had been kind of like planning that for like a year, like what college he was going to go to and what he was going to study. And he went and studied sports science, actually not sports science. He became a football analyst. Oh, nice. And so I remember moving back at the same time as him, but he was already there because he was older, you know, And I remember looking at him like, I can't understand why you're okay with this. why is it that you're not crying and I am? Yeah. But then you just realize that's just age, you know, and yeah. it just comes to you at a certain point. And it was a journey, I suppose.
I really hate it when those kids go on Britain's Got Talent and do stand up. It's always better than me, and it's so fucking annoying. I'm like, you're 10. How are you funnier than me? That is not fair. But also, when you're talking about emotions and stuff, you were learning and going into a career where you have to play on those emotions anyway. You have to be emotional. Mm. You know, that's part of what you do. I guess there's a certain control to it, but you know, it'd be weird if you weren't emotional because that is part of the job.
Yeah, I suppose. Not that I was maybe intellectualizing it that much at 14, 15. I think I was just buzzing to get a job, I think, back then. But yeah, for sure, I think it definitely is a line of work where you've got to be prepared to be available emotionally, and it does become, depending on, you know, there's plenty of ways to skin a cat, but depending on which way you want to go about acting, it can become currency, I suppose, for you in your work and fuel it but at the time I was just riding the wave, I suppose. Yeah. But it's funny you should say about those comedians at Britain's Got Talent. It just reminds me because I never let him live it down, really, because obviously. And also he was in Nativity as well, you know, the Christmas film.
Was he one of the kids?
He's one of the kids in that, yeah.
Oh, is he? Which one?
He's the one with the individual spiky hair with the glasses.
Oh, yeah.
So that's Jake, my mate, and
because my kids absolutely love that movie.
You can't argue with it.
No,
it's a classic.
It's solid. Like, it's solid.
It sort of does what it says.
It just comes round for him every single year. He gets so many messages because it's always on telly, and he doesn't act anymore. He works at a school, but all his students.
That's ironic as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, because all his students like give him stick for it, and I still give him stick for his Britain's Got Talent. His main joke on that was like, he's absolutely diddy, and he had this broad Scarborough accent. He'd say, "I've got a green ball in this hand and a green ball in this hand. What do I have? Kermit the Frog begging for mercy."
He should not be telling that joke at 10.
Yeah, I know. I think that was what did it. I think that was what...
Simon Cowell's all over that joke.
Amazing.
Yeah, for sure. But there you go. Oh,
I love it.
Sorry, didn't mean to make that sound.
You can make, mate, if your podcast, you can make whatever sound you want.
Yeah. We're all friends here.
No, I was going to say, what were some of those first productions you started doing though? I know you said you were doing like Fridays and Saturdays. You would be starting to do. Were you preparing for productions that you were going to be putting on at the?
It was mostly kind of sort of professional work there, I suppose. But funny enough, like the school doesn't actually do that much like outward performing. They kind of tend to keep it fairly like insular. The kids just do professional work, I suppose. But I suppose the biggest thing, which was definitely like something that made it back to all my friends in Cyprus, was like after like 3 or 4 months there, I got to be like an extra, and a very, very peripheral extra as well, I should say, on like the last Harry Potter film.
Oh, wow.
Definitely Hallows.
Yeah, for sure. And like it was, the school got culled, basically. They took like 100 kids from the school and just like lumped it because it was in the very last scene of the last film.
Oh, when there's loads of them, isn't it?
Yeah. And so we were all just like all the kids getting on the train. But like, even though I was like one in 100, like I just... as you know, I've grown up watching the film, so it's just unbelievable, you know. And everyone, all my mates back in Cyprus, like heard about it, and they actually thought I was like properly in the film. And I'd come back, I was like, I'm not in the film. Like, I was so embarrassed. Although, actually, this is a funny story as well. Like, so it was that scene on the platform, and you know, they're all like going to Hogwarts, and it's like, you know, 30 years in the future when Harry's grown up and that. And I was standing with these like two or three other mates from the school, and we'd just been lumped into a crowd like by the train, and they're preparing for this big shot, this kind of like tracking shot that's going to go all through the crowd and like eventually arrive at Harry. And I'm there in this big crowd, and there's this guy kind of, there's loads of people buzzing around doing everything, but there's this one guy who's in charge of animals, like he's the animals guy, and because obviously they've all got like pets at Hogwarts, and so he's going around like literally like doling out an owl and a ferret and all that kind of stuff. And I'm standing with these three other guys, and this chap comes up to me and just hands me a rat in a box and go, here, have this rat. And like, I was like, all right, thanks. And then before I have a chance to say anything, he's gone on to the next thing. And so then I'm just stood there for like half an hour waiting for this shot to start, holding this rat. I don't really like rats.
They're supposed to be clean, aren't they? But I mean,
it's not what you would have chosen.
No,
really.
No.
And so I'm there, like holding this rat in this box, and it absolutely stinks. And it's got the
smell.
Tail, and like I'm just not really keen. And it's taken ages. And so I say to one of the other guys I'm with, like, anyone want to hold this rat? Like, I don't really fancy it. And this other lad goes, yeah, I'll hold it, sure. And then literally about a minute after that, like one of the assistant directors comes up and goes, okay, who's got the rat? You, come with me. And he takes new rat guy all the way to the front and says, okay, when we start the shot, we just want you to literally walk directly across the frame, if that's all right, with the rat. And so literally I saw him go. And like, true enough, he walks straight across the frame. And in the film, you literally see him walk across the camera as the camera's sort of like panning through this crowd.
Oh, man.
So never let go of a rat. That's the moral, I suppose.
But what happened to him, though? I mean, what's happened to him?
Actually, he is an actor as well. And
okay.
Last year, I did a small part in this Netflix show that like shot in Prague, and he's one of the main characters of the show. And I actually ended up working with him for a week.
Oh, okay,
and that was like over 10 years later. Wow. So yeah, there you go.
Amazing. And he's still got the rat. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, I was just wondering if there was an opportunity for you to steal one of his scenes.
Yeah.
Giles, we have something exciting to announce here in the middle of the podcast, and that is that we are launching blank merchandise. It's official.
No way. Proper merchandise.
Proper merchandise. So if our listeners would like to buy blank merchandise, they can go to podcastmerch.co.uk/blank, and you can get, you can get a range of things, can't you?
You can get T-shirts, hoodies, mugs. What else? Baby grows,
because I'm sure, there's a lot of babies out there that love the Blank podcast. I know mine does. And you can also get, we've got various designs, haven't we? We've got one that's got our Blank logo on, and then we've got two that are inspired by pod guests.
Yeah, one of them was inspired by Rebecca Callard, who was on, I think, the 8th episode of the Blank Pod, and hers was to do with her video collection, which we were talked about at some length, and we thought that what video library, which was the video shop I worked in back in the 90s, was an excellent name for a romantic band of the 1980s.
Yeah, and then you made this this great what looks like album cover of you and me with hair from Flock of Seagulls. So we thought, you know what, let's make that into a design, so you can get that on t-shirts and hoodies and sweatshirts. And then we've got one that's inspired by Sanjeev Bhaskar when he talked about the three different stages of blank: fearful blank, neutral blank, and happy blank. And we've turned that into a design as well. So we've got various designs that people can get, and in different colours as well. I'm very excited by this, Charles.
I'm really excited. It feels like we're a proper thing now.
It does indeed. So if our listeners would like to buy some merch, the T-shirts, for example, are £18. The hoodies are £27. The tote bags are £17, and mugs are £15. And of course, we do get a small cut as well of everything that's sold. So if you'd like to support the pod, then you can do it in this way, and you'll get yourself some exclusive blank merchandise.
So go to podcastmerch.co.uk/blank.
I've got a question, actually, that just sort of popped up. At Sylvia Young's, do they offer, is it like emotional support? Because obviously, like, you're young and you're going into an industry where like it is tough and there's a lot of rejection and you could not be working for ages and all that. Do they prepare you for that?
Not really, I suppose. Like, it is quite tough there as a school. Like, I say tough. It's it's amazingly like vibrant, you know, and there's people everywhere, and there's such big personalities, and everyone feels really comfortable to be who they are and express themselves. And that's a great environment to be in as a kid. But then it is tough, and it is regimented and really disciplined. And they have kind of philosophy there that if you're here and you go out working and you're representing the school, and even if you're 12 years old, if you're a professional, then we're going to treat you like a professional. Yeah. And so they used to be like super strict on uniform and lateness and all that kind of stuff, purely because they want you to be ready. And that's the way they see the industry is going to be for you. And so why not prepare you for that? And like Sylvia, who's still alive and still works at the school, as far as I know, she's like got this zero tolerance policy of like stage school brats. Like,
yeah.
she just won't have it, because I think she's worried that is a kind of like something that would be synonymous with like theatre school kids, that they kind of get very arrogant and bratty, and she just won't have it.
Mm.
And I actually remember my dad, when I was at the school, he said, "Oh, I just saw a newspaper article that like where Sylvia had been interviewed," and I still remember this quote. Because the interviewer said to her, like, "Do you ever get kind of like stage school brats?" And she's like, "Yeah, sometimes we do, but I gently squash them." And I was like, that's probably what it was, really. You're probably gently squashed into being like a young professional, I suppose. But that makes it sound like the army. It really isn't. Like, it's a very fun place as well.
No, but I guess need some of that grounding, don't you? Because, like you say, when you go out, you might... Obviously, if you think you're the big guy I am or whatever, and you're going, you maybe get a few roles and you start to get there. But at some point, you might get, you know, you're going to get rejection. You're going to get hit down to earth, and you need to be able to deal with that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. It's completely inevitable. Like, no matter how far I think you progress in this line of work, and I haven't progressed particularly far. I'm, you know, still at the start, I suppose. It never stops. Yeah, that's just a reality that is there. And I always think of it as like, it's like snakes and ladders, you know, you'll climb three ladders and then you hit one snake and you're back down to where you started. And those are the realities. And so the sooner you kind of get to grips with them, the better, I think. And that was a really good foundation for me. I remember when I was there, like, I had some really big disappointments where I came close to something that could have been quite significant or really exciting. And it didn't happen. And it was like a really heartbreaking thing, but that's a great like lesson for you. Yeah, that's a great experience to go through, and it probably toughens you up and just, you know, teaches you that's the reality of the game, really. Like, it's an oversubscribed profession, and sure, you've got to be in it to win it, but there's a lot of people who want to win it, and it's just the way it is, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those industries where it's like it's hard not to take things personally, because it often is personal.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you walk in a room and you don't look right for whatever reason, but sometimes it's like, yeah, they don't want you specifically. And so you do have to deal with that.
You sound like you're speaking.
Oh, believe me. I keep choosing industries where
vague and charismatic is not always needed.
I change my career every like couple of years, and I keep choosing industries with so much rejection. I don't know why I keep doing that. I just need to be like an accountant, like my dad or something. Something a bit easier. But yeah, I think it is, as you said, there's so many people that I think, because I do comedy, obviously, and like my agent started putting me forward for like little TV bits here and stuff, and I haven't got anything yet, so obviously rejection has happened a lot. But there are lots of people, so I try to remind myself that I might feel crap after that, not getting that part or after bad audition or whatever, but there's also hundreds of people that feel the same. And weirdly, it's quite comforting to think that.
Yeah, for sure, I think. You've got to always try and keep things in perspective, you know, because it's such a cliche to the point where it's almost annoying, but like, people really are on their own path. Like, and there isn't a kind of a go-to way of, there isn't a conventional way of finding your route into success. Because it happens completely differently for everyone, and everyone found their own kind of way there, and everyone gets everyone hits brick walls and will be like knocking their head against those brick walls once they reach them, you know. And so it's something that you have to constantly remind yourself of, to not compare yourself to other people, and to try and kind of just stay focused on your own on your own progress, I suppose, and try and take stock as well. It's like what we were saying about GCSEs or A-levels, like it becomes a really difficult thing to go, oh, actually, you know what, I'm happy that happened and that's a good thing, and because you're so inclined to always look forward and go, what's next?
Yeah,
probably because there's that uncertainty if you don't know what the next thing is, you know, and so you're desperate to find it and for it to kind of materialize. But you know, I listened to a podcast with an actor recently who I really like, and he said, you've got always try and be happy but never content. And I think that's a good way of being, you know. You've got to be able to take stock of what's going on and the positive things that are happening, but then always, you know, still try and strive for more, because otherwise if you reach that ceiling, then what's the point anymore, you know?
What are you like in those moments though, when you know, when you've hit a bit of a wall, when you know, if things aren't quite going how you want them to?
It can be tough, like, for sure. Thankfully, I think a lot of actors are friends with actors, and so the people you go and look to for support and guidance also happen to know exactly how it feels. And they can help out. And also, you just got to remember, it's not the end of the world. Like, you know, as you know, we're not coal miners. You know? we're at the end of the day, we just want to do this thing because it's something, you know, I'd do it for free, you know. I'm really hugely lucky that the thing that is my hobby, the thing that I love doing, is also the thing that occasionally people will pay me to do, you know. Like, what a joy that is. Like, not everyone has that.
Yeah.
And so, just, you know, there's always another audition. It's like fishing as well, because no fisherman who does fishing as a hobby goes out every day expecting to catch a fish. They go out because it's something that it enriches their life. Maybe they do it with a friend. You're part of a community, you're part of something. And then if you get a fish, then that's a bonus, you know. and it's the other moments, it's the down moments when you're not catching anything and things aren't going your way, that you probably learn a few more lessons anyway.
That's a really nice analogy. Unfortunately, I'm also terrible at fishing, but that is a lovely analogy. That works really well. And I liked what you said. You talked about success a minute ago, and as you said that, I was thinking, like, I find success like a sort of an interesting word, but I try and frame it as it means different things to different people. So, because sometimes you feel like, I'm not progressing at all, or I'm not successful, I'm not where I want to be. But someone else looks at you and think, oh, he's done this, 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 and this.
Yeah,
he's doing really well. And I look at other people sometimes and think, they're doing really well. And then I might see them send a tweet saying, oh, I'm struggling at the moment. I think, but you're killing it. Like, yeah, it's all exactly. Perspective.
And especially on social media as well, that's a killer for it as well. Everyone's got this distorted idea of the way other people's lives are, and it's almost never that way, I think, or hopefully it's not, you know. but I think, yeah, and I've kind of realized that recently, kind of reflectively on myself, like, because obviously towards the end of last year I was in this show that came out and was on telly, and you know, that's like an objectively exciting thing, I think, that I'm really glad happened, and I feel very lucky that it's happening to me, and you try your best to not be too overwhelmed by it and to enjoy it, which was a challenge as well, to be fair. But to a lot of other people, I think you then, if I you know, if I am saying, like, posting about it on Instagram or something like that, which I don't do all that often, but you know, I do now and then if the show is on and stuff like that, then people might look at you and think, oh, you know, he's, you know, living the dream, which to an extent, as I say, it is what I'm glad it's happening. But like I was saying to my friend the other week, like, I'm still in lockdown. I'm still just sat here in my trackies living with my parents. Like my life isn't particularly exciting right now. Like, and obviously I'm still a lot more fortunate than others. And I'm counting my lucky stars that I was able to get that job done before this year and everything like that. But, like Instagram and all that kind of stuff would have you believe something entirely different. Like I'm living some kind of hedonistic sort of fun lifestyle. I'm just sat around here, you know, same as everyone else. It's a bit of a rubbish.
That's the problem with Instagram. It's like, I always think I should post a bit more. Like, it could be good for work and whatever. And then I go and do a story and I think, I've done nothing today. My life is so boring. Yeah. I can't even think of a 15-second video. Well, I've done nothing. How do these influencers like churn out this content? Like, I just don't get it.
Hats off to them, to be fair. I don't have a clue. And also, I struggle with it in general. And it's something I've had to kind of coax myself into doing a bit more and kind of force myself to be a bit more comfortable with it. Because kind of like that, like my base idea is like, why would anyone care? Like, who cares about what I'm doing in my life, you know? But like you say, whether we like it or not, it's probably a part of our jobs now to an extent, or it can be if you want it to be, but I suppose it can be as much, it can be that way as much as you want it to be at the same time. But I'm trying to find some kind of happy medium.
Me too,
I suppose.
Are there demands on you for that kind of stuff though, from, you know, production companies and stuff, when you've done a big project like, you know, like Industry, for example, which is obviously, you know, it's BBC, HBO, it's a big deal with regards to the production company. Is there a slight demand on you to do
There's not necessarily like a contractual demand, but there is like a bit of a nudge, I suppose, you know. And you've got people around you, good people as well. Not these aren't like cynical people. These people that are just doing their jobs as well, that are kind of encouraging you to kind of just, you know, share the news and publicize the show and be a part of people seeing it, which makes sense, really. It's not a it's not a crazy thing to think, and I think it's difficult. Like, I think actors struggle with it, and I struggle with it as well. And sometimes I look at other types of artists, like, you know, you'd never have a painter who would paint a painting and then never look at it, you know. And I find it difficult sometimes watching myself back on screen, especially because it's just an awkward thing to do. But then also I kind of don't want to, I try not to be one of those actors who hates it and like will walk out of a room, because, you know, that'd be a shame, I suppose, like, you know, to not have any appreciation of something that you've worked really hard on and you had a really good time making. You should be able to try and enjoy it. But so as I say, it's all been a bit of a learning curve for me, especially over the last few months, because it's been all of those things on a level that I've never experienced before. And it's been a pretty quick learning curve, and I've had to kind of, I suppose, work out the way I feel about those things. But as I say, I'm trying to find a good balance, I suppose.
Yeah. I was going to say, have you enjoyed that extra notoriety? I mean, it's good. I guess there's pros and cons to it, aren't there?
Yeah, exactly. Like if someone, you know, if someone sends you a message saying they really enjoyed the show, like yourself at the start of this, saying that you liked it, like that's never not going to be a nice, lovely thing. It's, you know, as I say, especially because all of us, the main cast in the show, were so young, like we really like gave it our all, and it was such a big deal to us, and it was such an important thing that someone had kind of given us the chance to be a part of something this huge, you know. So we really kind of put our heart and soul into it. So the fact that then someone does like it, it's great, you know. And so that's always going to be nice. There's other sides of it that aren't as nice and become a bit kind of intrusive or weird. Like when the show first came out, I had people sort of like impersonating me on WhatsApp, and they got hold of some of my contacts and things like that. And to be fair, that's just me. I'm sure people who are much more have much more notoriety than I do have it a lot worse than that. But even weird things like that, it's kind of, you do realize that these are maybe some of the things that you sacrificed in that kind of process, you know. But yeah, as I say, it's just, you sort of make peace with it and focus on all the positives that it's brought into your life, and just try and go with it, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by the lengths that people will go to on social media to be a twat. And I just don't get it. Yeah. Like, because it must,
is an awful lot of energy goes into being a twat.
I don't get it.
Like with stuff like that, you do think like you are going out of your way for that. you've really put some effort
going
into
the
that.
Extra mile,
You're wasting your time. It's strange, but yeah, that's the way it is. That's the nature of the beast, I suppose.
It does, I mean, Giles, obviously, you have a big social media following, and like your followers are normally very positive. I know you said sometimes people can be a bit negative on there. Unfortunately, social media has now left me a little bit cynical. So if someone sends me a message or a nice message or asking for something nice or help with something, my first thought was always, is this trolling? And if
well, ask him for say something nice to you. Oh,
I can't
man.
Think of anything like that. I, sometimes people so will ask for although I'd ask for
I really love your comedy. Oh, this must be
fuck off. My comedy's shit, mate. No, you don't. It's rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. Come on. Everyone knows it's shit.
Nice try, mum. But no, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, I'll happily do it, but like if are they sending me up? Is someone going to like learn take the piss out of me? Yeah, then I think, well, what's the worst thing that happened? The worst thing that happened is I tried to help someone or I retweeted someone saying something nice. Like, it's not, I don't think, even if other people are being dickheads, I don't think it reflects badly on you if you were then trying to be nice in return. Like, do you know what I mean? Ends up being trolling and they make you try and make you look a bit silly. I don't think it's ever silly to be sort of nice and kind. I guess that's the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah, I think you're always on safe ground there, I suppose, and that is that is the bonus of it as well. If if people do reach out and send you a message, you can respond, and say thanks and have a kind of a dialogue in that sense, and that's a real plus. Mm.
It's cool, man. How did that particular project come about? Did you audition, or was there? Were you headhunted for it?
No, yeah. So it's sort of regular channels, I suppose. Like, way after Sylvia's, like, went to college and then went to drama school and came out and, did 3 years of drama school and then just started auditioning and afterwards. Must have been the back end of 2018. I had like some really rubbish rejections, like three on the spin.
Oh, really?
Where like I'd kind of come close to it, and it was just before Christmas of 2018, and the last one, it was my last audition of the year, and it was something I was really, really passionate about, and I really desperately wanted to get, because I knew it was going to be a good thing, like, and it did end up being a good thing as well. I didn't get it, and I went home and just really dejected, as is the way, I suppose. And then and then came back and actually, God, he's getting some serious name drops in this, but then Jake, the Britain's Got Talent kid.
Mic drop.
Yeah, listen, he was living in Spain at the time, because he was just sort of taking like a gap year, I suppose. He just went to live in Seville for a year, and I hadn't seen him in a while, and the flights were so cheap, I just went out and stayed with him for like a week. And in January, by the way, great time to go on holiday is January, because it's not that we can now, obviously, but it really like lifted my spirits to spend some time with him and in a nice place I'd never been before. So then I kind of came back for the new year, kind of rejuvenated, and on the flight back from Spain, I got this like script through for this play that I read, this little play in London that I'm managed to end up booking and did that, and it was had a really lovely time doing it. And around the time that I was doing this play, I started auditioning for this thing called Industry, and I did like one or two tapes, and then they didn't really come to anything. And but then my
did self tapes where you
In fact, I think I did my first self tape for it in December, actually, the year before, when everything was going rubbish, but I didn't hear anything back. And so I was just getting on with this play, and then my very clever agent tried to bring a few casting directors to this play that I was doing, and she brought the casting director who's casting Industry, and they came to see it, and I think they enjoyed it, and I had a little chat with them afterwards, and I think that kind of jogged their memory a little bit, and they probably went back and looked at my tape or something like that. And so the following week I ended up back in the room for Industry, which was sort of something that I thought was long gone, and then from there kind of managed to kind of stay in the loop and probably end up doing about 5 or 6 auditions for it in the end.
Wow.
Which kind of resulted in like a chemistry read sort of screen test up in Cardiff.
Did they get more intense as you go on? I guess you'll just script reading.
You do more scenes, and you gradually meet more and more significant people. You meet the writers and then producers and directors and stuff like that. And each time it seems like a new challenge, I suppose, a new like a level up, I guess. And it eventually ended up in Cardiff, which is where we eventually shot the show. But we did like a screen test out there where they got other potential candidates, I suppose, for the roles, as you call it, you know, other actors, and they kind of put some of us together and tried out some combinations, and that was the kind of last round. And then, yeah, eventually heard after that that I managed to get the part, which I just, you know, couldn't believe, really.
I can say, what's that feeling like when the phone goes, or I don't know, was it your agent ringing you up saying you got the role?
I was for this one especially, just because I'd had those disappointments for TV stuff in December, and you don't want to let yourself get excited. Even by this point, you're trying everything in your power to not be excited about it, because you know it's just going to hurt more. And so in this one, I really genuinely thought I wasn't going to get it. I thought I knew the other guy, it was me or this other guy, and I knew who he was, and he was a bit more experienced than me. Really lovely person as well.
Famous for the rat scene in
But no, I knew this other guy, and I was just convinced they'd give it to him. And I think, you know, if it was me, I'd give it to him. When you come out of drama school, you do just spend all your time trying to convince people that you're ready. And it's a really exhausting thing, you feel like you want to shake people saying, I really think I can do this. And then, when someone eventually agrees, it's just, you never forget it. It was a great moment. It's one of the nicest parts of the job, you know, because that day when you get a job, no matter how big the job is, the day when you get that call, nothing can then spoil that day. It's just the nicest day, you know? It was good.
Jim, it's us again. And we've got some big news.
We have indeed. Giles, I can't believe I'm saying this. We've written a book about blank moments based on this very podcast.
Yeah, we've been recording this podcast for a while now. And as we've been doing, we've realised that everyone has these difficult blank moments. All our wonderful guests that we have on the podcast and our listeners get in touch with us all the time to tell us about their own situations, their own experiences of blank moments. And sometimes that can be from a personal life, from their career, the relationships they're in, or maybe it's a public situation.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those terms that can be applied to anything. Social anxiety, imposter syndrome, just sort of generally being off form, having an identity crisis. I mean, it's all part of the human condition, and yet we all get thrown off from time to time and sort of made to feel a bit helpless.
Yeah, so the book is made up of all these different chapters that sort of concentrate on these various themes that come up in the pod. So whether it's public failure, social anxiety, fear, mental health, grief, all the things that our amazing guests have talked about on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, and those guests include Louis Theroux, David Harbour, Reg D. Hunter, Dawn French, Rachel Paris, Amanda Abington, John Ronson, Rufus Sewell, Gary Lineker, all these people that really opened up to us about these difficult moments. And what we've done is we've dived into them, explained how we relate to them, talked a little bit about our own experiences, and almost gone on a journey of this discovering blank moments and how they've helped us. And we hopefully take the reader on a journey with us.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff in there for everybody, I think. It's a bit memoir, it's a bit self-help, and there's lots of interactive bits in there as well, so you can do your own gratitude list, and there's tips on if you're having sleeping problems. So all different things that you can take out of the book. And where can people get hold of this book, Jim?
Well, so it comes out in March in 2021, but it's available to pre-order right now from Amazon, waterstones.com and hive.co.uk.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to everyone getting their hands on it. And hopefully lots of people will be able to identify their own blank moments. And you never know what you might find out.
It's a really, it's a weird industry, isn't it? Where you're not trying to get excited the whole time about exciting things like that.
Yeah.
There's no other industry really where that happens.
Yeah. Like
if you're a I keep going back to accountant, don't I? Clearly, it's in my brain.
There's not a lot of things to get excited about.
Have you been doing your self-assessment today or something?
You know what? Actually, I have. Yeah.
Oh, I did mine a couple of weeks ago. I've done mine.
Oh, no, yeah. Actually, I need to actually pay it.
Handing your homework in late.
I hate doing my self-assessment so much. It's just...
Oh, it's a ball ache, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, just... whenever I like submit it, I always think it is like homework. That's true. I just think I bet there's so many errors in that, but I just don't care now. I'm just gonna do it and see what happens. And then
if I click that,
it's probably fine. I hope I didn't tick the box that said yes, I do tax avoidance schemes. So every year, who is ticking that box? Who's admitting to tax avoidance?
It's a weird box to put in.
We got the tax avoidance.
It's a very honest criminal.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, that problem doing criminal activities. I was too honest. But it's a weird industry where you have to sort of keep your emotions in check for that kind of stuff. Even though, and you're right about like, you know, nothing can ruin that day after that. But trying not to be excited, trying not to get too high, to be then sort of brought down by it. Yeah. Even though it's something that happens all the time.
Yeah, and you got like you go through like phases of like trying to micromanage that feeling. So everyone, I think at a certain point after you've left drama school, everyone's talking about like jinx and stuff. Like the 7-year-old thing of like don't jinx it. That suddenly becomes like a big part of your professional life. So like you go on an audition and then your friend be like, "How are you going?" You'd be like, "Don't jinx it." Like, you can't talk about it. And I went through like so many phases of that. Like for a while, I even did this really stupid thing where like every time I went to an audition, I'd walk out after it, no matter how it had gone, and the script that I had, I'd then find the nearest bin I could near the place that I was auditioning and put the script in the bin. Cause I thought that's a good like visual symbol of like, I've done it now, it's gone. Like I can't think about it. No matter what happens, it's in the bin. And then it didn't work. I was still thinking about it. And annoyingly, if you were lucky enough to get a recall, you have to go and bloody print it out again. I had to go back to like Ryman's again and spend another like £5 printing this script. So, and eventually I realized like, you know what, there's no such thing. Like you're either lucky or you're not. And you can do all these little suspicious things to try and superstitious things to try and as I say, micromanage that situation. But at the end of the day, it's going to go for you or it won't. And you have no control over that.
Well, yeah. And also you've gone in, you've done your bit. Like I often think sometimes like, oh, if I did that audition like a week later, would I have done anything different? Probably not. Like you do your bit, you are you, you look like you got your mannerisms and it's either yes or no, but it's not.
And that's
not worth worrying over.
Yeah, my dad would always say you just got to try and. I think he'd always try and he'd say it about football where you've got to try and control the controllables, you know, and take responsibility for everything that is your department. So make sure that you turn up and you're the best you can be, and you've done the work, and then you can, you know, it's a cliche, but then you can walk away knowing that was it, you know, and that you couldn't have done any more. And sometimes that won't always go the way because things will go against you and you'll have bad luck or whatever. But just do everything that's take responsibility for yourself really, and bring yourself to it, and then what will be, I guess.
Yeah, that is true.
I was interested about you said earlier about how you like the being this sort of the being in a team, like the ensemble, and obviously you know, industry is a big ensemble of characters and you know, a big cast. Was that nice as well, having that big family around you, and obviously younger people like you that have, you know, doing their first big roles as well?
Yeah, it was the best. It really was. Like, because like we were saying earlier about this trading floor set that the show's largely kind of based in, like, because of the nature of that, it's quite rare for a TV show where all the main characters are in the same place all the time. So and logistically, with the way that would work filming wise, is if there's a scene at another desk, even if like my character is not relevant to that scene whatsoever, I actually still have to be there on the day just in case the camera sees me in the background, because it would be weird if the main characters were never there, but the scenes that they weren't in. So it was this constant thing of like significant parts in the show were just kind of doing background work all the time. And that might sound like a bit of a drag. And sometimes it was like, you know, I would do like 12-hour days on set in scenes that I just wasn't in, and you're just kind of pretending to type away on your computer, like pretending to know anything about banking, basically. And so
you're like kind of a main role and an extra, in the same production.
In a way, yeah. And and you know, we had 80 extras, 80 like supporting artists who were all doing that with you as well. And but then because of that, it was kind of like really strengthened the relationship between everyone, because everyone is spending so much time at an actual workplace together. And we had this really, like you say, it's such an ensemble show. We had this really wonderful mixture of actors, different ages and different experiences and backgrounds. And it was a real like hodgepodge of people, but it just kind of like worked. And we did, we always went for dinner together and spent all so much time together. And like, and it was great for us as like you say, as younger actors, because all the older guys were just great and always happy to kind of share advice and stories. Like that's one of my favorite parts of the job as well. You find an actor, because actors don't mind telling a few stories as well.
We've met a few on this podcast.
I don't mind listening to them as well. So when you find an actor that's got a good few ones, you're happy to hear the war stories, you know? And to be fair as well, some of those older actors would say to us, like, it's not normally this good, you know, like people don't normally get along this well. And that's when you kind of know, like, oh, we have struck lucky here. The fact that we're having such a fun time and everyone's really kind and everyone's, you know, pulling in the same direction. There's no divas or anything like that.
That's amazing. Again, I was thinking about a football team as you were saying that. I've got to stop going back to football. It's literally my only reference point.
Yeah.
But I think that's really nice. And, you know, in a dream world, all jobs would be like that. But does that help as well, having that kind of camaraderie when maybe things aren't going so well on set, or you forget your lines or you're blank or something like that? I guess having people that are on your side rather than you feel like, oh, this guy hates me already and now I'm like screwing this up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you've always got those people to kind of fall back on and as I say, go to for advice or support, or and especially for us in terms of like the few leads in the show, like we're all new to the game as well, and we're all pretty fresh out of drama school, just like they are in the show, like just like the characters are. They're all, you know, fresh into this new bank and they don't know what to expect, and that was very much us. We were very kind of green, you know, it's a whole thing. And because of that, all like four of us were in the exact same scenario, and we were all kind of feeling the same, maybe at slightly different points, but generally going through the same experiences, you know. And so that's a great comfort. And yeah, it's as I say, it's one of the best things about being an actor, is being part of a team. I as a comedian, like, do you find, how do you kind of find that? You know, it's so much more of a solo kind of endeavor.
It is a bit, yeah, it is a bit like you, I've got friends in there. So like there's, I mean, when gigs were a thing, you know, you get a bad gig and you're driving back.
Just for lockdown,
I had a really like interesting one in a Bristol rugby club, which was very interesting.
Bristol rugby club sounds like
it wasn't.
This isn't anything against Bristol's own. I think it's quite.
Charles,
it sounds like it might be quite rowdy.
It was a Bristol rugby club. So it wasn't the good one.
I didn't hear the A bit at the beginning.
No, it was
just a Bristol rugby club.
And I was emceeing as well, and it was, oh my god, it was tough. It was a learning curve. I mean, they actually really enjoyed the night in the end, and it was okay. And I hope that got back to my agent. But I quite like, actually, when you're starting out in comedy, you're often driving bigger acts to shows and stuff, and you're like, you're the support act doing 10 minutes and you're driving the headliner. These days, if you're doing sort of opening 20 or closing 20 or emceeing or whatever, you'd normally drive yourself. I quite like that, actually. I quite like being with my thoughts, like up to the gig, listen to
you
the music,
prepare,
and on the way back, if it's a 2 or 3 hour drive home, I can sort of go over it. Again, like when I play football, go over it and think about what I've done and stuff. And if you did a bad gig, there is definitely sort of team spirit with the comedians. Like four or five of you, it's like, right, we're going to get through this together. So I'd imagine like sort of like being in the trenches. Like that's a terrible comparison. I'm probably like, I've never even been in a fight in school. But like, there's definitely a sort of like, let's get through this together kind of spirit thing. But I think you have to be someone as well that's comfortable being on your own, I think, and being with your own thoughts.
Sure.
And you certainly don't have as much camaraderie day to day, I don't think, that you would do, you know, being an actor on set. It's a weird one. And at the moment, it's not even happening. So I don't even... I can't even die in Bristol at the moment. You know what I mean?
I dream of dying in Bristol.
I'm getting heckled by rugby fans in Bristol. That'd be amazing. But no, it's a weird one at the moment.
Yeah, I bet.
But all entertainment is an interesting industry. You know, whatever arm you go into, acting or comedy or presenting or whatever, it is a weird industry. Mm-hmm. But also, as you said earlier in the chat, it is almost something you would do for free as well. So even when you're having those bad times, like just to remember, like, I plugged away for ages just trying to get 5 minutes on stage for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I would do this for anything. So you do have to check yourself. I remember the first time I got paid to do comedy, and I think literally think it was £10. Might have been 15. And it felt like I'd won the lottery. Like, it felt like someone just gave me £1 million. I couldn't believe it. But they paid me to be on stage and talk bollocks for 10 minutes. I couldn't believe it. And then as you go on and do more and more, you sort of get a little bit more, you treat it like a job because it is a job. But you do, I think you lose sight of that sometimes, that you're doing this crazy thing you love. So and you take the sort of rough and the smooth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you desperately try not to. You desperately try to keep hold of that kind of innocence with it, I suppose, and not let it be kind of, you know, get mixed in with the practical sense that it is a job. And then sometimes it's useful to think of it as a job, because then it kind of streamlines things for you and makes it's a bit more practical, I suppose. And, you know, sometimes it can be hard as well. Like, it's, you know, as I say, like, we're not minors, and we're not saving lives. But, like, you know, on a set, you're often doing like 14-15 hour days, and that's kind of the way it is. And it can be high pressure, I suppose. Like, you've got to be ready to do your thing when people want you to do it. You know, ready to perform at the right time. And I always think of it like being a footballer, because, as I said, like, my entire childhood was based around football, and I was brought up around football. And my brother works in football. He works for Bristol City, actually. And,
Shit, maybe he was there that night.
he knows, like, he has no connection to, like, the acting world whatsoever. He can't really relate to it in that much. But, like, I always find that speaking to him about it through football is such a great analogy for it, because... yeah, they're both pretty high pressure performance industries that with banking as well, like the high pressure, high reward, you know, and you're expected to kind of deliver at the right time. But as you say, you can't lose sight of that. And that was really one of the nice things about, one of the lovely things really about being able to do a job like this. I actually had a really nice chat not too long ago with Marisa, who plays Yasmin in the show. And we were talking this year when sort of lockdown got eased earlier on in the year. We met up for some drinks for a friend's birthday, and we were chatting and sort of looking back on the show and stuff like that, because it wasn't too long before it was coming out. And we both said, we didn't say it to each other at the time when we were shooting it, but having this conversation, we realized that, like I said, that we both thought the same thing at slightly different moments. And it was this idea that, like, we got there in terms of, not that we've made it, but we got there to the part where we actually get to do something as kind of exciting and as big as this. And there was a kind of real feeling of, like, relief as well, just like a relief that, not that you've arrived there, but like a relief that it actually felt this good and was, like, this enjoyable, and, like, and it was genuinely fulfilling as, like, a job. Like oh wow, I've really worked hard to get here, and it actually feels great. Like, I actually love going to work every day. Like, what a relief. that I don't hate it. You know, what a relief that it really genuinely makes me happier, you know? And that just makes, you know, that, if anything, more than anything else, makes you want to chase more, makes you want to get back on set and do more, you know?
That's amazing. That's a wonderful thing, actually, to reflect on something and think, actually, that was everything that we'd hoped it would be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you can ask, like you say, you can't really ask for anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Really. Yeah, sure.
That's brilliant. Well, Harry, thank you so much for talking to us this evening. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, I've got one more question.
Okay, sorry, Jim.
Have you got a Cypriot team?
Oh, I don't really. The big team out there is Apoel Nicosia, I suppose. And I did go to a few of their games. And I've been to a few Cypriot national side games before, because they kept on drawing Wales.
I remember that. Yeah, what, European,
like,
qualifiers?
Yeah, in European qualifiers. Yeah, like, yeah. Year after year, they kept on drawing Wales. And so it seemed like a good match to go and watch. So I've been to watch a few Cypriot national side games. But it's a different ball game out there as Cypriot football, because, like, they've often had a few kind of, There's a lot of politics involved, and my distinct memory actually was, I went to watch a game with my dad. I must have been like 7 or 8, and there was a night game on, And it was quite a big game in the Cypriot League. So my dad was like, oh, let's go and have a look, see what it's like. And I had quite bad asthma as a kid. And Cypriot football fans, these blokes, they love a fag. So I was like, I was sat in the stand and like 360 degrees all around me. It was about every single man was smoking. And it's just like, I could barely see the pitch. It was just like a cloud of smoke. And we had to leave at half time because I couldn't breathe.
And,
that's embarrassing, isn't it? But yeah, so that's my defining memory of Cypriot football, actually. I couldn't hack it. But, so yeah, not quite.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, not quite Hull City, is it?
Yeah, it's not quite the Tigers at the KC, you know.
Well, Harry, thank you so much, man. It's been really, really great to talk to you. And yeah, like I say, big fan of Industry. I recommend anyone to go and watch it. It's on iPlayer for quite a while, I think, so hopefully people can catch up if they haven't seen it already. But yeah, really loved it, and I look forward to seeing you in lots of other things.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for taking the time. Really enjoyed it.
Well, there you go. That was Harry Lawty on the Blank Podcast. What a great guest.
What a nice guy. Brilliant, brilliant guest. Like, again, I know we talk about doing these over Zoom and not in person, and it's great we can connect to people, but you could tell, even over Zoom, someone with a really nice energy, just a really nice positive energy that, you know, would have been lovely to meet up with for a coffee. And, you know, maybe we'll go to a Hull City game at some point in the future when we're allowed to be together. But
when we're both in the Championship.
We and Palace are inevitably back in the Championship. But yeah, lovely guy. So some really nice advice in there. You know, it's really refreshing for a young actor to be looking at the industry and the game so almost with an older head on his shoulders. I thought he spoke so well about it. I love the analogy about the fishing, people that fish don't go all the time to catch something, and I thought that was a really nice way to describe.
And the snakes and ladders as well. I thought that was a really good analogy
He had some really good advice in there, and I think he's going to have a fantastic career, and I wish him all the best because he deserves it. You know, really nice guy. So thank you so much to Harry for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Harry. It was a great chat. And that's the end of another Blank Podcast, Jim.
It is indeed. We'll be back next week with another guest.
We will.
Of course, as we crack on into the second century of Blank Podcasts.
Oh, I tell you what, we've got some amazing guests lined up.
We have. We're so lucky to chat to these people and, from different backgrounds, different industries, and they're all just an absolute joy to really spend time with. So, and people like it. Our numbers seem to be going up, and we get more listeners all the time, and we're number one in Cuba or whatever it was. And, people seem to really, get on board of the pod. So thank you. If you're still listening to this bit of the podcast, you're a legend. Thank you. And if you are new to the pod, we appreciate you taking time out to listen, and thank you very much. Every single listen to us really means the world.
It really does. It really does. And it's been lovely to hear from lots of new listeners. So, so please keep spreading the word.
Please do.
And you can contact us as well.
Oh, seamlessly done. We're on Twitter. That's the main one. We're on Twitter, and our handle is
@blankpod. But you can also contact us on Instagram and Facebook,
which is also @blankpod.
Yeah. And you can email us if you like those sort of medieval types of telecommunications.
Seems really arcade, doesn't it? Almost like texting. You know what I mean?
It's all WhatsApp now, isn't it?
Exactly. If you're not on WhatsApp, what's wrong with you? Our email address is theblankpodcast2018 @gmail.com.
Yeah. Doesn't date us too much.
No. And that's it. Have a wonderful week, Giles. And
you, Jim.
Thank you, mate. And we'll see you next week. And same to our listeners. Have a great week, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. And we'll see you again next week for another episode of The Blank Podcast.
is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.